Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right. Hope everybody's had a great week. Welcome back to another episode of Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit. Yeah, buddy, we are getting cracking here today. This is going to be a great episode. Matt and I are going to go over our top five favorite guns of all time. So this podcast, if you're tuning in, definitely appreciate you coming back. Be sure to go over on all of the podcast services. Make sure you give us a good thumbs up, good rating, all that good stuff that helps us in the search algorithms. Also, if you're following us here on YouTube, howdy, guys. Good to see you. So we are filming this particular podcast as well. You can check it out on YouTube if you want as well. And obviously vice versa, podcast versus YouTube. We do publish these on YouTube.
You do. You get access to them quicker if you listen to it in audio format.
There you go.
Yeah,
you,
by about a day.
Yeah, you get it a day early if you go and listen to it on podcast. So for your Friday drive to or from work, you can, you know, put on your podcast, hang out a little bit. Okay.
And hear us in all our glory.
Before we get rolling here today, I'd like to give a shout out to the show sponsor, Koi CBD. They have some amazing CBD products, oils, balms, gummies, flower, all kind of awesome stuff. I love their Delta 8 products. I have terrible back pain and it really helps with my back pain. They also do some amazing dog treats. So if you've got some dogs that are crazy like mine, or maybe you've got an elderly dog that's got some bad back pain or something, that will definitely help them sleep and get around a lot better. These guys are super veteran and police friendly, really awesome dudes. If you'd like to support them, use the code LLP. That's Lima Papa for you military folks, and you'll receive 15% off. So check them out, Koi CBD. So with the Five Guns videos, we really do get into the weeds on a lot of different subjects and things like that. But this is a great podcast. So we can really get into our personal views on what we just look for in guns and just go over some favorites. And doesn't necessarily have to be practical all the time. Doesn't necessarily have to be something that you would use for self-defense. This is just whatever. It just your own personal reasons. And we'll go over that a little bit here in this podcast. So, I mean, what do you think overall?
I mean, when I'm thinking... Earlier when you said our top five guns to shoot, I think of, you know, just what's fun. Like, what's a fun gun to shoot? And if I'm taking that over practicality, I mean, that Fosbury, Mark Novak brought down when he came down for the podcast, and then he brought a couple of guns with him as well. But that Fosbury was, if you guys don't know, it's a revolver. The precursor to the Chiapa, what we know as the Chiapa Rhino, operates completely different, but the way that it's set up and the way that it looks is very similar. It's a semi-automatic revolver because it actuates like a slide on the top. Just a super interesting gun, really smooth to shoot actually. And it was just fun. It was just one of those guns where, yes, they're unobtainium for the most part because you can't find them. But it's just awesome. I enjoyed it.
I really enjoy having Mark Novak down, and that was such a great time. Mm-hmm. One thing that I will mention is the Matiba. Yes. That uses that underbore type of thing in a semi-auto form.
That's what it was.
But also there are lines from the, you mentioned the Chiapa Rhino.
Yep.
That type of concept is something they took from the Matiba.
Yes.
More so, I think, is what you were probably thinking there. And we, oddly enough, it's weird that we thought about, he mentioned the Rhino, because that made me think about him bringing down the Matiba. So we have a video with Mark where we go over the Matiba and the Fosbury. Those guns are so neat to think that you're talking a semi-auto revolver.
Yeah.
It's such the strangest thing. And we just did an episode on our favorite war movies. So if you check out last week's episode, you'll get to hear our take on our favorite war films and things.
Oh, yeah.
But one thing that I'd like to mention on that end, when I think of the Fosbury revolver, I think of Sean Connery in the film Zardoz, and he's playing Ned. It's a crazy film, but in some of the one of the shots there, he takes a Fosbury and picks it up out of, you know, the giant head pukes all the guns out, and he picks up the Fosbury and he reaches up and he goes, cocks it, you know, and then starts shooting people. It's just such a cool film. But the Fosbury is an interesting gun design. And that's a great pick.
Yep.
That's a great way to start this this podcast off.
Well, you know, I will mention that that reminded me of those old school movies where they're using revolvers. You're watching them and like they're triggered. What we would call trigger discipline today is horrendous because like they're all like just, you know, booger hooking it like this. But then you have to remember that it's like a 12-pound trigger on a revolver. It's really only going to go off if you wanted to. There's no like 80s. It's all double action. So it really puts it in perspective, like, I guess, the different techniques and tactics that they had back then.
That's right. An interesting thing on that Fosbury as well is that you do get a single action trigger squeeze because, you know, when that that upper frame reciprocates and, you know, indexes the gun and cocks the hammer. So it is a true single action semi-automatic revolver, which is so cool. Such an interesting gun. And that's not a gun that a lot of people have access to and get to shoot often. So really big shout out to Mark Novak and Anvil Gunsmithing.
Oh, yeah. Great guy.
For coming down and showcasing that really cool piece of hardware with us. We always relish in the opportunity to pick Mark Novak's brain. Sorry, I can't talk. The coffee's talking. Right. But Mark is such a great dude and great. That's awesome way to start out this podcast. So I guess it's my turn.
Yes, it is.
All right. So, man, favorite guns. Wow. I mean, this is getting into the weeds, seriously, because there are so many different firearms, and I've been really, really lucky over the years to have gotten to play around with a ton of different things. Some stuff is really outlandish. I mean, all right. I don't know if I have footage of me shooting it. I probably don't, but I recall we were on an FPS Russia shoot one time and they broke out a 20 millimeter Lottie. Okay. You know, it may have been the Swiss Solothurn. It was one of the 20 millimeters. The Solothurn, I believe, is the one that has the big crank on it, but it may be the Lottie that has the crank. So some of you folks that know those 20 millimeter guns a little bit better than I do, maybe you can correct me. I want to think it was a Finnish Lottie, the anti-tank rifle or whatever. It's the one that had the big crazy crank on it. So to actually withdraw the humongous massive bolt on this 20 millimeter, you actually had to crank. You had a crank that helped you retract the bolt. And then once you overcame a certain part of the travel of the cog, the way the timing was, or whatever, it would allow the bolt to slam home. So to charge this thing, you would like, and this humongous reciprocating mass of metal would chamber the first round. And we actually had some original, like high explosive, you know, original German 20 millimeter ammunition.
That doesn't sound dangerous at all.
Yeah, Ira Sellers actually brought that down. Good friend of ours, and he is absolutely one of the foremost in the United States. He's definitely one of the most foremost experts on those big bore artillery pieces and tanks and field pieces and anti-tank rifles and things like that. But I recall shooting this thing. Now, you know, you obviously shoot this thing from the prone. Now, I actually don't think it was a Solothurn because it was either the Lottie or the Solothurn 1 was mounted on these like big skis. It was actually intended. So I guess Finland would have had the Lottie.
Yeah.
So this might have been the Solothurn is the one I'm thinking of. But it was the one big Swiss Solothurn, a whole bunch of like, you know, ratcheting.
Let us know in the comments.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll be corrected on that. But so this gun, man, you know, you shoot it from the prone and you lay behind it and the muzzle brake on this thing is like a 15-pound mass of steel. Like, all the gases escape through these crazy ports, and it's this nuts gonzo muzzle brake. And it's obnoxiously loud. It's so loud, it sounds like a cannon exploding or something. And the recoil, you would think, you're shooting this 20-millimeter, it's this big, crazy anti-tank rifle, and you would think that the recoil would be crazy. It doesn't kick any more than like a 12-gauge shotgun.
Man, they got a good gas system in there.
Oh, well, the muzzle brake is a big part of that. Yeah, and the recoil system. But it was such an interesting experience to shoot that gun. And it's not something that a lot of people get to shoot very often, especially with the, you know, high explosive ammo and all of that type of stuff. And if you refer to the FPS Russia video on that 20 millimeter anti-tank gun, that is the gun in the video, is the one that we shot on film that day. And Chad and I filmed that video for Kyle. So that was back when we were doing some of the FPS Russia productions, which, you know, I'm not going to get in too far on that. But Kyle was a great guy, and we hope that he is, you know, happy and doing his thing. And we support Kyle 110%. We support Kyle's family 110%. So I've never really publicly said a whole lot about that, but I will just say that I have a lot of respect for the Myers family, and I think he's a good guy. And we really enjoyed filming a lot of those videos for FPS Russia, and the 20mm episode was one of them, and that was one of my favorite experiences shooting a gun by far.
Dude, that is awesome. I've never shot a like I say civilian model 20mm, and frankly enough, and I don't know how this happened, but I think it was probably about maybe a year ago. For some odd reason, I went down this rabbit hole of trying to find 20mm rifles. And there's actually guys out there that are custom making these things. So if you go and search for them, they're not inexpensive by any means, but I mean, there's stuff out by Knights that costs more than a custom 20mm rifle. At that point, is it a cannon? I mean, it's like you're firing a shoulder cannon at that point. But yeah, you can get them. I think the price points were anywhere between like $8,000 and $10,000 for this thing. But the ammunition is really the expensive part, right?
So yeah, so some of those destructive devices, I hate calling them that, but that's what, for the purposes of NFA and laws and transferring them and owning them and everything like that, they fall under what's called a destructive device. It's pretty weird and ambiguous. I'm not going to try to explain it, but they are so much fun. You know, I love large bore, big explosions, loud, lots of powder going off. I mean, the larger stuff gets, the crazier it gets. It's just awesome. So, all right. So what's your next one?
All right. So we did a handgun. You did a shoulder mounted cannon.
Anti-tank rifle.
I'm going to do crew served. I think you're getting thrown off by this. My favorite big bore crew serve weapon, 120mm mortar.
Okay. We're going to get into the weeds on the 120mm mortar.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, people underestimate that.
It is a gun.
Yeah. It's a very large gun and it works very well. It's very effective on the battlefield. But the amount of fun, I've never had more fun dropping rounds into something than a mortar. I'm not even going to say 120. Like, yeah, that's like the biggest one available, but even like dropping rounds on 60s and 81s, so much fun. Even the training rounds are fun. You don't even mind going to find the round because you have to dig it out of the ground, but it's so fun. You're volunteering to go out there with the shovel and to kind of dig up these rounds and replace the shotgun shell and drop another round. But overall, one of my favorites.
Well, you just really brought back some memories. So in case you guys don't know, Matt and I served together on the same mortar crew. Shout out to all the 11 Charlies out there, infantry guys. You know, we're infantry with benefits.
That's right.
If you will. We are the infantry guys that understand a little more math than your average infantryman, and maybe we can, you know, figure out a few, maybe a little bit more complex problems than the standard grunt.
That's right. See, I thought that a math test they gave us that first week of basic was just like, it was like a 12 problem, one page. It was like basic addition, basic subtraction. And I thought this was a joke. And then next thing you know, everybody turned the tests in. All the guys that did good on that math test, Charlie's. Everybody right. else that failed, bravos.
That's right. So Matt and I served together 05, 06 in Iraq as well in Mortar Platoon. So I won't get into the weeds on that. That's a whole other thing we can talk about. But we know our way around the mortar systems. They are neat. And I feel that a mortar is one of the most useful weapons on the battlefield. And I guess this is getting more into the tactical use of the mortar more so than the experience of shooting it. And I know a lot of people are wanting to know why they're our favorites, but I guess we could get into that too. I mean, the sound of a mortar is just insane. It's really loud, and there's just a ton of powder burning, especially on a full charge. You've got these little cheese charges, and they kind of look like little foam cheese wedges.
Yeah, they look like a cheese wedge that goes around a fin.
Yeah, they're made out of this kind of like weird cardboard foam that just kind of breaks and pops and you tear it. But it has looks like a little piece of cheese, so we call them cheese charges. Yep. So like if when the fire direction control, when they send down order, they're going to tell you what charge the round is. That's part of the overall, you know, process of calling the mortar section into action. We won't go into that, but they'll call for the charge. Well, a lot of times you'll have these charges left over. And I remember when we used to burn the cheese charges in these humongous piles, and when you would light them, it just looked like the gates of hell opening up for a second
there. Well, it's pure nitroglycerin. So there are like thousands and thousands of these nitroglycerin pellets in there. Like if you busted open those cheese charges, it looks like just BBs, but they're a nitroglycerin.
Yeah.
And they burn so hot. Like when you're like in the burn pit, just you could feel it from like 20 feet away. You can feel the heat. It's powerful.
And I always like that. It almost looks like a crazy double base gunpowder when you look at it, when you break the charges open. And then when you burn it, it's crazy. And I love like the glass bowl that's left over in the sand afterwards and you can like pick it up and it's like melted. It's really cool. The mortar is an awesome weapon system. I do believe the military undervalues them, underutilizes them. Just a quick tactical point why I like mortars. Quick before we move on. I like the fact that they can be fired from a hidden position, dug down into the ground, that you can't see from anywhere around it unless you're on top. So you can actually dig them down into a pit. And as long as you have like mass and overhead clearance and the round can get out through like trees, you can shoot them from underneath trees pretty easily. You can shoot them over hills and the hill can be relatively close to you. So you can actually lob it up and down at relatively close ranges. And those are one of the limitations of traditional artillery that might be fired from a much longer range. The trajectory of the round is so long that you may not be able to clear a hill. A mortar crew can get in close and get over a fighting position right in front of them with a mortar. And they're a lot harder to detect where the crew is actually firing from with a mortar section over an artillery section. An artillery, you know, is not as mobile either. A 60 millimeter gunner can, you know, grab the tube and the butt plate, the little hip mortar plate. What do they call that thing?
Just a mortar plate.
Yeah. You're right, but they call it a hip shot plate, like a little tiny itty bitty plate.
Oh, from the hand fire, because they have the 60s have two base plates.
That's correct. Yes. You got the big base plate, and then you got the one where you could be hiding in a ditch somewhere and you're just about to ruin their day.
They got those little square ones,
but they're much more mobile. You can pick it up, move somewhere else, and by the time they figure out where you're at, you're gone.
Yep. And I mean, the 60 millimeter is super, super versatile. Set up, like all mortar systems are set up to be like 3-man or 4-man systems. The 60, honestly, like it's a 1-man system. They break it down into 3 people just to help carry the gear. But when you're doing like a hip fire, you're not even using the sight. It's a line of sight, like basically you're just firing with your eyesight.
Wow. We could get in the weeds on mortars, but that's a great one. So, all right, we had the Fosbury, and then what was my choice?
The 20 millimeter,
the 20 millimeter anti-tank gun, and then we had the
shoulder cannon.
That's a lot of crazy stuff going on right there. I think I'll simmer down. We're gonna get back down to a slightly different plane here, and we're gonna talk about real quick. We'll talk about hunting rifles. You know, so I recently introduced Matt to deer hunting.
Love it.
I've been deer hunting a long time, but there are certain rifles that to me just They sort of define your hunting career in a way, like what you've done in the world of hunting. And for me, I like the Ruger M77 Mark II action, primarily the boat paddle stock version. I know you've seen them with the Zytel stocks. I like the all-weather model because it's stainless steel. You got the Zytel stock. They chambered them in a ton of different calibers, some even in some awesome big bore calibers. I've got a 9.3x62, and it's amazing. But I've got a ton of M77 Mark II all-weather rifles. I love them. They are absolutely my favorite guns. They are very light, dependable. They'll never rust on you. They're always reliable. They always do the job. They're accurate. And I just love that particular gun. And to me, that like defined my visions of, you know, sitting in a deer stand with my grandpa and things when I was younger. I mean, it's always been my go-to rifle, and I've owned one of those deer rifles since I was like 14 years old. So I've had them a long time.
That's a great choice, and that's the same exact choice for me. I mean, that is the same exact rifle that you gifted me. Eric started me off deer hunting. I didn't even own a deer rifle, a traditional deer rifle. I mean, yeah, you can hunt with the 5.56. I mean, people hunt with 22 Magnum, 22 LR. But I guess Eric really wanted me to have a proper hunting rifle. And he let me use his Mauser initially. And that thing was a tack driver. That Mauser was absolutely amazing. And it was in 30-06. You know, when we took the first deer, it was, I think we used like a 187 on the very first deer. And then we switched to 220s SP. And that 220 out of that 30-06, man, it is just a monster. Even out to, I think the farthest I hit was like 140. I think we measured it out. You lasered it at 140. That was the farthest with the 220.
And that's, yes. So we've got a deer hunting spot we call the coyote stand. Mm-hmm. And it's because we hunt coyotes down there all the time. And I've got one of those big old 5-cell Baronet blinds, the really huge ones. And it's just easier to maneuver cameras and stuff when we're trying to film. But the end of that trail is like 142 yards.
Yeah, that buck popped out at like last light at the very end. He knew what he was doing. He's like, I'm just going to wait another minute or two for that sun to go down. And he stepped out at the wrong time. That was a max range shot. Boom, just dropped like a sack of potatoes.
Yeah.
So
deer hunting's fun, and I think everybody should have a good deer hunting rifle, you know?
Dude, that, and I think the reason he gifted me that was because he can get his Mauser back.
That's exactly why.
Because I think I got like 5 deer out of that Mauser, and I was like, he couldn't get it from my hands. I was like holding on to it, and then he was like, well, here, take this.
No, those M77 Mark IIs are great, and that's a great way to tie that story, and I actually didn't even intend for that to be the story.
So yeah.
We kind of just went right into the weeds on that.
Well, that's awesome. What it's all about.
That's good. A hunting rifle, I think, is a pretty valuable thing that people should, you know, be skilled with. I think that every hunter, you know, should be able to take a pie plate, and we're not talking the gigantic pie plates like you get in South Louisiana, okay? Like, I'm talking like, you know, an 8-inch pie plate. You ought to be able to take a little white 8-inch pie plate and stick it up on a post 100 yards away, and you should be able to take your hunting rifle, your deer rifle, and you should be able to hit that plate with an offhand shot without even thinking about it. And if you can't do that, learn to do it. Because, you know, your skills as a hunter, you got to be able to shoot offhand, and I think it's important. You'll take a lot of offhand shots in the field.
You really will.
A lot of people assume you're going to have a really nice rest. They assume that you're going to be able to prop the gun up, or you're going to have some fancy rifle rest. I mean, field positions and shooting at game in the field, you will sometimes need to take an offhand shot, and it's nice to be able to make that shot. Now, obviously, you want to take ethical shot and make sure that, you know, you're going to take a shot that you're not going to potentially wound the animal or something. You want to make an ethical kill. But I think shooting offhand is a valuable skill. You might not have a choice. You may have to shoot offhand, right? What if a wild boar charges you that's trying to hurt you or something, or a pack of wolves or some crazy rabid animal? So you may have to present the firearm quickly and defend yourself against a vicious animal or something as well. So, my 2 cents on that.
I you're absolutely right. When you're out there, I think half of the shots that I ended up taking that trip were offhand, just because you're not always in a good position to have a rest, whether it's a monopod or a saddle setup, whatever they call it.
The hog saddle.
You know, some of those blinds can accommodate that. If you're in a tree stand, definitely not. I mean, you're in a stand, you might be able to use the arm safety rest. But if you have to kind of stand up to get a better vantage point on it, you're offhand. It is a valuable asset to be able to do that. I think if it's an infantry thing, because I've never been through non-infantry basic training or training, because it was one station unit training. I don't know what other MOSs, what their marksmanship training is like during basic training, but I feel that that really ingrains in you coming out of that, that confidence to be able to hit something. Because, I mean, it's been years since we've had to do anything like that, but that confidence to be able to pick up a rifle, acquire a sight picture with just iron sights, and know that you can hit something at 200 yards or 300 yards, like just knowing that you can do that, it just gives you a little bit more confidence. Because when I was out for that very first deer hunt, and it's like 140 shot, I didn't even hesitate because it's already ingrained in you. You're like, all right, well, I know I can hit it. Now I just have to make sure I do everything I can to make it an ethical shot.
That's right.
Whereas some people, they go out and they've never done that type of training. They start getting nervous. They start second guessing themselves. And then there goes dinner because you lost them.
Great points there. All right. So it's your turn to go. What would be another one of your favorite guns?
Let's see. We just did hunting rifles. I'm going to do carbine, just a regular old carbine. So let's just do self-defense. So if you're doing a home defense, self-defense carbine, we're not talking like anything crazy. I mean, it's really, really hard to beat like an M&P 15, like a Sport 2, just like nothing super high end. Gets a gas system, direct impingement, you know, reputable manufacturer. It holds up very well. Never had any issues out of it. And, you know, we've all shot tons of different ARs, you know, no malfunctions, good accessories, inexpensive for the most part. And that's just because of the brand. They're, you know, M&P, that M&P Sporter is, it's like a budget AR and it does exactly what you need it to do.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. I mean, I agree. I would say that in terms of a, you know, an AR that is a very affordable AR, but still good quality, definitely mm-hmm. Smith. I think that people really get hung up a lot on something needing to be expensive. Like they associate expense with high quality. And here's the thing now, on the end of upper end ARs and things like that, yeah, that is the case. I mean, as you start to get into some of the nice LWRCs and I don't even want to rattle off manufacturers because I don't want to leave someone out. But mm-hmm. like, you know, whether it's Daniel Defense, Geissele, LMT, you know, LaRue. I mean, there's so many great makers out there. And I'm only scratching the surface with PWS. I mean, gosh, I'm going to forget people here. But, you know, Noveski. Gosh, there's just so many.
So many.
Bravo Company USA. I mean, BCM arguably created and sort of, you know, is the reason that the market is the way it is because BCM yep. paved that path. I mean, there are so many great companies yep. making such an awesome AR. And yeah, the prices can go all over the place. But I, you know, no matter what you spend, whether I mean like an H&K, mm-hmm. I mean, I keep thinking in the back of my mind, who am I forgetting? But you know, POF, I mean, there's so many quality guns out there. The fight lights are awesome. And so it's easy to get in the weeds of, well, it has to be expensive. I have to spend the most money I can and get the craziest thing I can. It's good to hear you say that because someone can buy an M&P and just put, you know, a decent optic on it. You know, you might want to free float the rail, you know, put a Geissele rail or something on it mm-hmm. With a low profile block. You know, there's a few little basic tweaks that you can do and it can be a really great gun. I mean, we've shot them all the way out to I think 600 yards at the farm. And I mean, I've ran, so my buddy Mark has an M&P 15 and it's a relatively basic rifle. He bought a really nice ACOG and put on it. It was a flat top rifle, just a pick rail on top. And he dropped an ACOG on it and he didn't upgrade the trigger. He didn't upgrade the fore end, any of that stuff. It was just a standard M&P with an ACOG on it. And we took a regular triple G Lithuanian SS-109 ammunition, 62 grain ammunition, and we zeroed the gun per the specs, and we got out to 500 yards.
Dang.
And we were shooting that gun out to 500 without any difficulty at all. Now, I mean, is the consistency going to be the same as like a BCM, you know, 18-inch BCM match barrel and, you know, a good Geissele trigger and, you know, a really, really nice fore end and good mounting system for the barrel and all. I mean, is it going to shoot like that? Of course not. But for, you know, an $800 gun, is it something that if you got in a pinch and needed to protect yourself, I mean, what, the threat's 550 yards away? Come on. You know, it works perfectly good for, let's just say, the casual glance of craziness. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to throw one down a mountain somewhere and have to rely on it. But then again, I wouldn't throw any gun down a mountain. So why am I going to, you know, apply some crazy standard to that gun that I wouldn't apply to any other gun? I think what I look more for in an AR is just longevity. You know, can it go a long time without being cleaned? Can it continue to cycle and function and work in a wide variety of different environments? Will it feed and work with a bunch of different ammunition no matter what I can find?
That's crucial.
I mean, yeah. Crucial. Will it work with a whole bunch of different magazines? You know, are the pins rattling out of it left and right? What's going on, right? Is stuff loose every time I shoot it? So it's like, as long as the gun holds together and works with anything I could throw in it, who cares what it costs as long as it works? And I feel like a gun like that, you're going to be more willing to go out and train and get dirty and roll around in the dirt or do whatever you're going to do, or actually take it out and shoot it and train with it and carry it around in your vehicle and stuff like that. Because, you know, you're not worried about it being a $3,000, you know, fancy thing. You have less money in it, so you're not going to baby it as much. You're actually going to get, you know, use it.
Well, I mean, that brings up a very valid point, because that's exactly how I have my, I guess, daily life is set up. So I have my home defense guns. Those are not the same guns that I roll around with in my car or that I have at my shop. So what you said was that it has to be a gun that can store well. You can lubricate it. It's gonna just hang on to that lubrication, because, you know, you might go in there every 6 months, check the batteries. The way I have mine set up is it's in my closet. I have that set up. I have my armor there. I have my optic. It's shake awake. But every six months you go in there, you kind of just test your optic out. That's not what you want to. You don't want to find out your batteries are dead.
Yep.
You know, when that happens.
PCCs and PCIs. Yeah.
That's right. But it's every six months. So you're checking. You should be doing that across the board on all of your optics. Even the one that you carry around in your car. But I have that set up, and it's stowed. So you have oil on the bolt. The ejection port is closed, and it sits in that corner 365 days a year. I pick it up. I'm already familiar with it. I have a different rifle for my car, so that stays in my car. Same thing. Stays in that one section of my car, stowed. You know, I have to make sure that everything is working. So you're not going to have a $3,000, well, not me personally, I'm not going to have a $3,000, you know, Daniel Defense Mark 18 decked out sitting in my closet for 365 days a year, and have another Mark 18 $3,000 set up sitting in my car, and then have another one in my go bag. Yeah, I have to think practically, you know.
That's right.
So, you know, the M&P for me, it's great price point. It's very reliable, not ammo sensitive. I'm not worried about, you know, putting in different types of ammo in there. Is it going to cycle? Is it not going to cycle? Because that's the thing with a lot of these really high-end rifles. They are ammo sensitive. So you have to run specific grain. You have to run specific, you know, no steel, has to be this, has to be that, you know, has to be subsonic. So you need something that's not ammo sensitive, that you know you trust your life to.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's, you know, in this modern manufacturing and everything, and the quality that people are building their guns to, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, there aren't a lot of other guns too, even over the M&P or any other stuff in that price range, it wouldn't hold up just as good. I mean, it's probably more of a fluke that you find a gun that won't run most everything. Some guns might be a little bit picky on the power of the ammo or the weight of the ammo, or certain twist in the barrel might, you know, they might not, you know, stabilize certain projectiles well, but
buffers might
buffer weights. Yeah. But overall, I mean, I would say that most companies that are making an AR, especially that's in the, you know, $600 or $700 price range, like average entry level price, generally holding up okay. I'd say some are better than others, and I would definitely say that in the world of entry level ARs, that the Smith & Wesson is certainly near the top.
I agree.
For me, and I think that's a fair assessment. All right, so I guess it's my turn to do another gun. All right, so man, we dove into some really cool territory. My favorite gun. I mean, when I think favorite, well, why would it be my favorite? Is it nostalgia of what I, you know, go through when I'm enjoying, you know, shooting this gun? Is it a gun that is involved in a film or something? So there's all these things I'm thinking about. I mean, that 20 millimeter, man, that was really, really cool. Of course, who doesn't love shooting a mortar?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who doesn't love the security you get from a good patrol rifle, like a good 16-inch AR or even a Mark 18?
But how many people really had the opportunity to shoot a mortar? That's the beauty of it.
You know? I'm not second-guessing that at all.
There's such a small group of people that have had the privilege of hanging a mortar round and just letting it fly.
Especially, you know, in a war zone.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so, all right.
Yep.
We're going to dive into, I'm going to say, the P90.
Mm.
So the first time I shot a real deal FN P90, oh man, I remember it like it was yesterday. They are so much fun. Man, they're so fast. And the 50 rounds of ammunition you got, a really short compact package, really futuristic looking gun with really strange alien looking ergonomics. I mean, there's just something about the P90 that kind of draws you in, right? Even the cartridge itself, you know, the 5.7 by 28 millimeter is very, you know, it's an odd cartridge. It's not quite a rifle cartridge. It's not quite a pistol cartridge, but it's more rifle cartridge than it is pistol cartridge. It gets into this strange territory where it doesn't know what it wants to be. Is it a personal defense weapon for only, you know, getting in a fight in a phone booth like the old MAC-10s and stuff? All right, is it that? Or is it this 200 yard and in personal defense / offensive type of SMG? I mean, and the rate of fire, it's full automatic. You obviously can switch it to semi on the select fire ones, but on full automatic, lots and lots of firepower. I mean, a pack of angry hornets coming right out of the dang thing. Wow, it's just such a neat piece of hardware. Now, right now, the ammunition is ungodly expensive. We actually do have a machine gun pack for our P90, you know, that we manufactured, and it's awesome. I just don't get to shoot it much because ammo is kind of hard to come by these days.
Yeah, every time you go in a store, that's like you're just looking for like one or two boxes of 5.7. But
have you shot a P90 before?
I have, yeah. Not a full auto, but a semi. It's a very, very interesting impulse recoil or impulse reaction on it because it's not what you would expect. It's because everything is like essentially, I don't even know, it's like a helical mag, but it's like not a bullpup. It's a regular, you know, SMG. It's just, I don't know what the classification is. It's like the original PCC is what it would be classified as. But you hit one that I really enjoy, which is the Mac series, whether it's a Mac 10 or a Mac 11. Not the most accurate, but you just cannot beat it. Like as far as like the fun factor, the range toy, just the looks, it just looks like, especially when it has the original like silencer on there, like that really big fat silencer that doubles as a handguard. So you'll see. So that is designed, just so you guys know, it's designed for you to hold on to. You'll see people like talking. You'll see when you see like video of it, like, oh, he's holding onto the suppressor, the silencer. Like, it's designed that way. That's why it's so big. It's supposed to absorb a lot of heat. Now, I don't know how long you want to hold on to it for because it will heat up, but it was initially designed for that.
Those Psyonix suppressor designs are really crazy, you know, the old school designs. And I'm not going to get in the weeds over suppressor design because I'm not a subject matter expert on that enough to articulate it the way I'd want to. There are several people we could probably have a talk about suppressors in a future podcast. We probably will do that. Maybe we'll get Kevin Bringham or a few other folks and do a little chat about can development. That can be a future episode all in its own spinoff. But that particular machine gun, one of the jokes about it was that, yeah, it's only good for getting in a fight in a phone booth.
That's right.
And it's true in a kind of way. You know, they're not real accurate. The original intention of the MAC-10 was to be issued to radio crews, mortar crews, even like medics trucks that just need a short, light, handy, compact weapon. Also a weapon that could be mass produced and, you know, put in pilots, seats, survival kits. I mean, they were really marketing as a general purpose, light SMG that could stow away in a variety of different small spaces and be able to be deployed quickly and provide a wall of firepower that's very reliable. And also the overall expense of them being very, very, very affordable. So it was marketed to a lot of poorer countries that could not afford some of the, you know, more expensive machine guns of the era, like, you know, you get into a MP5 or something like that.
H&K.
Any H&K subguns are going to cost a lot of money for a military or department to buy. So the MAC-10 was also marketed as a cheap and effective submachine gun that a lot of the poor countries could purchase for their military and law enforcement. So, and they were used, you know, all around the world and continue to be used. And because they're so affordable at the time, of course, they just make for a very approachable type of machine gun that someone could get into. And also on the NFA realm of things, when you look at the registry, you do see a lot of MAC-10s on the registry overall. So because they were so affordable, they represent a very, you know, if you can even use the word cheap, a very cheap option for someone wanting to get into a transferable machine gun.
Yeah, that's like your entry level.
There's a lot of MAC-10s out there.
That's like the entry level, like NFA. A lot of people cut their NFA teeth on MAC-10s. I mean, before the whole pandemic, you would see them regularly, and they would range anywhere between, you know, $6,500 up to like $10,000, which is kind of like one being just the gun in the magazine, the other one being like the full, like, whole kit, original kit and all that stuff would go about for about $10,000. And now I haven't looked what they go for, but I'm sure it's considerably more.
They're not $189 anymore. Yep. Let's just say that.
But I will say real quick, about the MAC-10, like the versatility of it, it's like a transformer. I mean, I've seen like all these different types of kits. They have like a shotgun kit where it actually like will shoot shotgun shells out of a MAC-10.
I have seen those conversions. That's pretty crazy.
And just all kinds of stuff, I guess, because of the simplicity of the design.
It's a crude blowback. You know, it's very functional. Yep. And it works and everything like that. It's also worth noting, I was going to say just then, I'll reiterate there, Barry, our old co-host, now he's no longer with us, unfortunately. Barry's passed away, but our original Gun Gripes co-host, Barry, used to work for RPB and used to make MAC-10. So, you know, he had a lot of pride in, you know, in that particular aspect of it. And any time a MAC came through, of course, it was always cool to see an RPB thinking that, you know, maybe that was a gun that you built yourself, you know. So he worked for RPB making MAC-10s. And, it's just really interesting. I wish it'd be really neat to get some, you know, do some research somehow and figure out which serial number ranges he made.
At
RPB.
One.
And if we could figure that out and dial it down, maybe procure one of the MAC-10s that Barry made himself. That would be kind of a nostalgic thing.
It would be
for me to have. I'd love to have that. And of course, we miss Barry, but always big shout out to him and, you know, for making us who we are today and helping us get here. But the MAC-10 will always mean that for me.
I'm trying to figure
every
out
time I shoot a MAC-10, I'll always think of Barry.
Would they even have those on file? I don't think those they're in business anymore, right? Cobra Ingram?
No, RPB, they were just a different manufacturer of them. And they you know, made them out of Georgia.
Yeah, obviously. I think it's Powder Springs is where.
Yeah, there's a lot of different you know, people that produce the MAC-10 variant, you know,
that's true.
Of those guns. I mean, you've got, now you got Masterpiece Arms makes a semi-automatic version. And actually, Phil up there at Masterpiece has done a fantastic job of modernizing, that basic blowback, I'm sorry, design as well. Can't talk today. Actually, it's the coffee talking here.
Too much.
All right. I got some coffee to lubricate my words here a little bit. But, you know, when you look at that particular blowback design, you know, Phil did a fantastic job of modernizing that blowback design. All right. And you also see his Glock grip stick that he designed.
Yep.
So now you've got a gun that doesn't rely on these old school M10 mags that are getting harder and harder to find, and they're expensive as crap. Now you've got something you can buy a common Glock mag for. And you've got, you know, a more modern take on a classic design. So, you know, that's really cool. I don't know if you've ever shot any of the Masterpiece offerings, but we could probably get one down and try it out one
day
if you
want. Excellent.
Yeah. So, all right. So I guess it's my turn to choose another gun. So we've gone down some really cool rabbit holes here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the coolest guns that I ever get to shoot, obviously, would be a machine gun of any sort, anything that's full auto. As people get into the gun world, and this will probably be the last one, we're running a little close on time here, but when people get into guns, you kind of start small and work your way up. And for some people, maybe it's like, hey, I shot this crazy big bore gun, and that was like the apex of what I did in the gun world, and I really thought that was cool. Or maybe it's someone who gets to shoot different machine guns, and then the machine gun aspect becomes cool because you're getting into the mechanical aspects of how things work, and you know, generally the machine guns get more complex in the mechanisms. So you might be the kind of person that's into engineering and stuff, and you're like, wow, I'm just, you know, fascinated by how this device works. You get into that end of it. But I think for me, it's always been, you know, the subguns. I like the subguns.
You have been a subgun kind of guy.
I do like the subguns. Now, I'm probably going to catch a bunch of hate here. I'm going to catch some hate, so I'm just going to go ahead and just get this out of the way, okay? I'm not one of those kind of people that thinks that a 9mm SMG is better than a 10.5 or 12.5 inch AR in 5.56, okay? I would always, if for home, for protecting myself, obviously, yes, I'd rather have an AR all day long over an SMG. I'm talking about more about the fun and aesthetics of shooting it and why I just like it because of the concept. That's more my thing. So don't think that that would be my choice for protecting myself. I'd rather choose a rifle, obviously, over an SMG. But I've always been fascinated by SMGs. I think because of the way Hollywood portrays them, and you look at the action movies, and they're always using some light, compact type of machine gun, right? I mean, who can forget Escape from New York? Yeah, I believe it's Escape from New York or Escape from LA with Kurt Russell, right? Well, I guess they made both of them.
I think
movies.
New York was first.
So it was the New York first, yeah, because I remember it's Isaac Hayes.
Yeah.
And Isaac Hayes is sitting on this couch, and he's dressed like this crazy pimp character, you know, and it's so cool. You know, he's got, I believe if I remember right, he's got this white, you know, frilled jacket on. You know, he just looks like a boss, you know, and he picks up this MAC-10. And what do you see? It's this glorious MAC-10 with a suppressor on it, and it's got an optic on it. You know, and the optic is attached to the suppressor, and it's the most weird looking thing you would ever see. And it doesn't look practical, but there's something about it. You're like, I want to shoot this. Like, I don't care what it is. I just want to shoot this. I must shoot it. And then he actually does, you know, fire it. And that's just really cool, you know? So I've always been fascinated with subguns. And part of it is the culture, the pop culture end of it. I mean, who hasn't remembered every random James Bond film with some villain using some random foreign 9mm subgun to engage, well, attempt to engage Bond as he runs around and, I don't know, karate chops and whatever he does. But who doesn't like the lore of that? And that's why I've always been fascinated with subguns. With all of that being said, all right, the last gun, I'm going to have to say the Russian PPSH submachine gun.
Oh, that's a beauty.
My gosh, I love them.
The rate of fire on that thing is intoxicating.
It is absolutely riveting, man.
Yeah.
They are awesome.
That is definitely on my bucket list to do. I just want to, I don't want the stick. I want the drum. You know, yeah. They're going to, here's the whole drum. And you just, whoa, just let it go. I saw a parts kit for a North Korean PPSH. I think it was like, I want to say it was maybe like 10,000. Like 10,000 seems to be like that starting point for like NFA items. But it was like a PPSH like North Korean kit, and I was like, oh, I want that. But it's such an obscure like type of thing, and you had to find the rest of the parts to put it together. But that gun is absolutely amazing.
I love the PPSH. I mean, with the 72-round drum magazine, I like the capacity. I like the weight. I like how it points really naturally. It's a crude design. It's really simple. You know, this cheap sheet metal. There's this industrial thing to it. Like, you pick it up, and it's just an industrial device. Like, it's not a weapon. It's not an honorable firearm. It is an industrial device that delivers lead. At such velocities and such speeds that the enemy wants to run in terror. And that is what it does. Like, it's awesome.
It does, and it does it in style. Because if you look at the gun aesthetically with the drum, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
You take the drum off.
And it looks scary.
It does.
Imagine 50 dudes in a line coming at you, how intimidating it is.
But the way that barrel throws the fireball, like it literally throws it like four different, the way that it's ported, the heat shield on it, it's like designed to intimidate you. The fireball that comes out the front is made that the people behind the first row don't want to keep coming. But the simplicity of it, when you look at it, if you pull the drum off, it's almost a straight line. It's like literally you see the stock, it kind of curves up a little bit before you say you can get your hand around it and hold on to it. But if that little slight bend wasn't there, it'd be like trying to hold a broom because all you're doing is putting a drum on there and the rate of fire.
The PPSH is a neat piece of hardware, and I really have to hand it to the Russians because they came up with probably one of the best mass-produced machine guns, especially of that type and especially for the time. In history, PPSH is seriously a great piece of hardware. I love the rate of fire. It is just so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the 72 round drums. And I didn't mention earlier, I love the cartridge. All right. 7.62x25 is such a cool cartridge. And it doesn't matter if I shoot it in a Tokarev or a CZ52 or anything chambered in that cartridge. I love it. It's just, it's this really cool take on the old 30 Mauser broom handle. And it's fast and it's hot, and especially out of the length of a barrel mm-hmm. on a PPSH, it is screaming. And I would not want to go up against one. I can tell you that right now.
I don't know why they didn't.
It's got to be a frightening thing hearing that thing getting shot at you.
Well, I don't know why they haven't followed up with, you know, a modern day. Could you imagine that same rate of fire out of a similar caliber, a modern caliber, with a gun that's been modernized? That, but still like kind of enshrines the original look. So imagine like a polymer version with like pick rails so you could actually deck it out. Oh man, that would scare the living bejesus out of me, knowing if I had to go into a room and one of the guys in that room has that and you have to clear that room, good luck.
Well, we weren't exactly able to get five in on this particular episode, so we will revisit and go over some other scenarios and other things without repeating ourselves. So if you like this particular concept, let me know if you want us to do more of these in podcast form, because there are other guns that I'd like to kind of explain my overall thought process on and what makes me like them.
I'm sure you have a ton of guns.
Well, of course. So we can get into the weeds on this if you guys want. We can make this a ongoing thing. So let me know what you think. We can do more of these episodes. We'd love to hear from you. Definitely go in on the back end and make sure you give us a good solid like and thumbs up on the video here. If you're watching on YouTube, also over on the podcast servers, give us a thumbs up, good rating. That helps us
absolutely
out with the search results and everything. Thank you guys very much for tuning in. There are so many cool guns out there, and there's so many things that we associate with them for different reasons. And I think this is cool. Like, it lays out the culture of why we like guns and the true in-depth reasons, and not so much just a blanket statement that is so bottled and cold and exacting and imprecise. So I feel like these get in more, into more of the minutia, the lore of why gun owners like guns and the things that we associate with them when we shoot them. So
that's a very valid and good perception.
Yeah. Let's get into the weeds. Yep. Join us. All right. So we'll see you every week. Thank you for tuning in both on YouTube. If listen on the podcast, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Have a great week. We will see you next week. Many more podcasts. And if you're watching, videos on the way, and we will see you soon. Have a great week.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Inc. by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.